right, welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two cases on the docket this morning, one at 9 a.m. and one at 10:30, so we will take a little break in between the two. Our first case this morning is City of Willow Park versus ES and CM Inc. And I understand counsel have checked in. If our clerk will please announce who will be arguing today. All right, thank you. All right, Mr. Pratt, we'll begin with you.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Good morning, Justice Dauphineau. Good morning, Justice Walker. Good morning, counsel. May it please the court. Your Honors, the starting point in this case is one of immunity. This case involves a governmental unit, City of Willow Park, and a contract that the city entered into with ES and CM, which I'll refer to today as the consultant. Now, as we set out in the briefing initially, the threshold question is whether the plea to the jurisdiction filed by the city should have been granted and whether the trial court erred in denying that plea. And if the court would excuse me, I've got a little bit of a cold today, so I'm going to try not to.
I think everybody does.
The statute that's at issue in this threshold question is Texas Local Government Code 271.152. Now, that statute admittedly waives immunity in certain limited circumstances. We're not disputing the fact that that statute does waive immunity. What we are disputing is the effect of that statute in this case. This case, as set forth in the briefing, involves a contract which provided in section 12.11 that the parties agree that the city has not waived its sovereign immunity by entering into and performing its obligations under this agreement. Now, if we line that up with the statute itself, the statute says entering into a contract waives sovereign immunity to suit for the purpose of adjudicating a claim of breach of contract. So if we line those two up, we've got the sovereign immunity piece. That is the constant term. So we start off with the general principle that governmental units have immunity from suit. We then take step two with the statute in which the legislature has admittedly waived that sovereign immunity in the limited circumstances of breach of contract. But then we take step three, and we look at the contract itself between the parties, and that contract effectively reinstates that sovereign immunity. This is not a question of creating a new right. It's not a question of waiving something that's only left to the legislature to waive. The legislature already waived it. We admit that. But these parties entering into a binding contract agreed to reinstate that immunity. Otherwise, why is the language there? And the Supreme Court has told us in the NAFTA Traders case that the parties are certainly free to do this. And that case stands for the proposition that freedom of contract, more than another public policy, tells us that parties should have the utmost liberty of contracting, and furthermore, that the courts shall hold those contracts sacred and shall enforce those contracts. Bottom line in this case is we have a contract in which the parties agreed that the city was not waiving its immunity, and I'm going to emphasize it one more time, by entering into and performing its obligations under the agreement. So we know from that language that we're taking what was a waiver of immunity for a breach of contract and we're putting it back in place.
But doesn't that non-waiver clause really just make that part of the contract an issue in a breach of contract claim and cause of action?
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, in other words, you all agreed to that provision in your agreement. So really it's just another term of your agreement and could be properly raised in a contract litigation situation as opposed to the preliminary plea to a jurisdiction.
Well, I think that where it comes into play is, the language that I've emphasized, by entering into and performing its obligations. That language necessarily relates to a breach of contract issue. So we're not disputing that there could be a lawsuit between these parties on other grounds, injunctive relief, declaratory judgment claims for other issues. But when it comes to breach of contract, the language of that statute says the city has not waived its sovereign immunity. So when the consultant brings its breach of contract claim, we have to jump to that provision of the contract. We have to jump to section 12.11, and we then see that the contract is very clear. The city has not waived its sovereign immunity.
Could you read that entire provision again, please?
Which one, Your Honor? The contract,
the waiver?
Or the contract or the statute?
The contract.
The contract itself, of course. The parties agree.
And where is it exactly?
It's section 12.11. I believe it's page 62 of the record, if I remember correct. It is, Judge. Page 62 of the clerk's record, section 12.11, heading Sovereign Immunity. The parties agree that the city has not waived its sovereign immunity by entering into and performing its obligations under this agreement.
So if the city doesn't perform its obligations under the agreement, then there's no waiver? I mean, isn't that the plain language of that provision? That there's no waiver only if the city performs? If the city doesn't perform, there's no waiver?
Well, I think we're looking at it in its entirety, Your Honor. It's a matter of, does the city waive it by entering into it? I mean, that's what the statute...
Well, I would understand that if the word performance weren't in there. But by performing, you're not waiving. But by not performing, then...
I think in that context, we would look at performance and non-performance as one and the same. I mean, it's a question of, do they perform? They might not perform as the contract states, but the bottom line is that provision is in place to tell us that there's no waiver of sovereign immunity. Otherwise, why would we put it there? There would never be a breach of contract claim if there was full and total performance, or if there was never a dispute over full and total performance. So by putting it there, we know that sovereign immunity has effectively been reinstated. There could be claims that are outside of breach of contract, that if there's a statute providing a waiver of immunity, or if there's some other basis for the city to be drawn into court, then that's fine. But when it comes to breach of contract, this provision tells us that immunity was put back in place. And again, under the NAFTA case, they were free to do this. Furthermore, under the anti-waiver laws of this state, they were free to do that because there was no provision in the statute that disallowed that provision of the statute, that provision of the local government code, to be waived. And Texas courts, as cited in the brief, therefore presume that the parties may freely waive the statute. So there's no anti-waiver statute, then we know they can waive it. We look at the contract, we know that they did waive a waiver. It's kind of a double step, but it effectively reverses the first waiver and puts the immunity back in place. Simply stated, the contract says what it says and it means what it means, and that's how we have to read it, that's how we have to apply it. And the end result when we do that is the city had immunity put back in place and could not be brought into court. And again, under the NAFTA case, this court, as the trial court should have, must hold those words sacred and must enforce them. Now, there's been a question at the trial court level and in briefing before this court on the counterclaims raised by the city. But we know from the Riata construction case and the Riata doctrine that any waiver that's caused by seeking affirmative relief, by the city seeking affirmative relief, Any waiver is limited to the amount of damages that would offset those claims. So even if we get to that point, even if we say no, immunity was waived because the city filed a counterclaim, the maximum amount that the consultant can draw from that is the offset. So, and this makes sense in light of the public policy of immunity and not using tax dollars to pay judgments and pay attorney's fees and things of that nature. So if the city wants to come in and raise an affirmative claim, then it can. And it, in certain circumstances, that will constitute a waiver of immunity, but it's limited in that only that amount can be offset or used as an offset against what the private party would seek to recover. And in fact, this court addressed the same issue in the Munster Hospital case, which Justice Walker, I believe you wrote the opinion on, and stated that the waiver extends only so far as the claims act as offsets. Immunity continues for affirmative damage claims which exceed the amount necessary to offset the claims raised by the governmental entity. So even if there was a waiver in this case by the counterclaims being asserted, it's limited to those amounts that can be used as an offset, and that is the sole extent and the farthest extent to which that waiver can be applied.
Well, wouldn't that be a independent ground for the trial court's denial of the plea to the jurisdiction?
It potentially could have, yes, Judge. And to the extent that the court believes that that's the case, then we would ask that the court modify or direct the trial court to modify the judgment to that extent, because what we have here is an order that's very broad. It's just a denial of the plea to the jurisdiction and an award of attorney's fees. So there's independent grounds, of course, or there could be independent grounds. We don't know because the order is very broad. It's not specific. So to the extent that that would be appropriate, then we would ask the court to modify the judgment in that regard. On the second issue before the court is one of attorney's fees. And again, we're still dealing with the Texas Local Government Code, and we're moving on from 271.152 to 271.153, which does, in its current state, allow attorney's fees to be recovered in breach of contract claims. But what's important in this case is that that statute applies only to contracts that were entered into after June 19th of 2009. Prior to that, the subchapter of the local government code expressly denied the party's rights or the private party's rights to recover attorney's fees from the governmental unit. Now, when the legislature enacted this and gave trial courts the discretion to award attorney's fees in certain circumstances, it did so with the express condition, as laid out in House Bill 987, that it be limited to only those cases dealing with contracts after June of 2009. And this is reflected in the notes to the former statute. And Section 17 of the House Bill provides that the change in law made by this act applies only to a claim that arises under a contract executed on or after the effective date of this act, which again was June 19th of 2009. Now, this limitation was further explained by the 14th Court of Appeals in Houston in the Harris County flood case, in which the court effectively pointed out the very language that was in the statute. And the Supreme Court went on in the Sherryland case to cite the very quote that the Houston Court of Appeals provided in that opinion. During the 2009 legislative session, Section 271.153A was amended to add that a plaintiff could recover reasonable and necessary attorney's fees. However, that amendment took effect on June 19th, 2009, and only applies to contracts executed after that date. The contract in this case was prior to that date. Therefore, there can be no other conclusion but that attorney's fees in this case could not be awarded to the consultant should not have been awarded to the consultant. And by awarding them to the consultant, the trial court erred under the statute itself and under the Supreme Court's decision in Sherryland. This is not a case of unilateral interpretations or extrapolated conclusions as was set forth in the brief. It's clear. The statute says it. The Houston Court of Appeals has said it. The Texas Supreme Court has said it. Now, I've got just a couple of minutes left, and I'd like to talk real quick about the procedural timing of this issue. In the briefing, there was a question raised by the consultant that this is a matter that should have been left to a motion for summary judgment and that a plea to the jurisdiction was an inappropriate avenue for raising that challenge. But the 14th Court of Appeals in Houston and the Dallas Court of Appeals have both addressed this issue, and the Houston Court in particular said that a plea to the jurisdiction is an appropriate vehicle by which to challenge attorney's fees. And if there are no further questions, I thank the court for its time.
Thank you, Mr. Pratt. Mr. Smith?
Please the court. Good morning. Good morning. Justice Duffino, Chief Justice Livingston, Justice Walker. I appreciate being here. I always appreciate the opportunity to make an argument. Just, I want to fill in just quickly. I know that I'm going to get directly into the sovereign immunity question, but just so there's a little bit of background, a little bit more background in terms of exactly what happened. You know, the firm that we represent, ESCM, is an engineering firm. They were contracted by the city to prepare plans, do engineering, and eventually the construction of a wastewater service system for the delivery of both water and for wastewater preparation back in 2008. And it was a contract, it was a written contract between the city and the entity to provide that service. And so we've kind of fought this litigation battle for a few years now, and there were some previous attorneys that were involved, and they had a line of defense. And then this group of attorneys now has another line of defense, which is, for the most part, the sovereign immunity issue. And so I think a good place to begin, obviously, is with the actual clause itself, where it says that the parties agree. The parties agree that the city does not waive its sovereign immunity by entering into and performing obligations under the contract. The contention of the appellant is that somehow that effectuates a waiver of a waiver, essentially a waiver. The legislature has already made a determination pursuant to its authority for 150 years in Texas case law as to the scope of what sovereign immunity really is. And so sovereign immunity, dating back to the king can do no wrong, the origin of it, and it's sovereign immunity is something that's possessed by each state in the Union, as well as the United States. And it has always been the province of the legislature to make a determination as to a waiver of sovereign immunity. So if you look at it as a pie of sovereign immunity, and they click out a particular section of that piece of pie with regard to, in this case, a written contract engaged by a municipality for the delivery of goods and services by an engineering firm in this case. And so if it's a written contract by a city and it's executed properly by the person in the authority of the city, then in that case there is a lack of sovereign immunity at that point. And so the question, the idea that somehow that the city has the authority to make the decision that the legislature has already made with regard to sovereign immunity defies, you know, the history of Texas law. And in fact, in this case, I believe that the attorney that constructed the contract, sitting in the courtroom here today, Mr. Ryder Scott, he contracted with ESCM and included in the contract, the provision that counsel has already referred to and that I just spoke about. Their contention that somehow that effectuates a waiver of a waiver, I think defies, number one, the actual words of the clause itself, say something different. Because if you read it where it says that the parties agree that the city does not waive its sovereign immunity. Well, the city doesn't have sovereign immunity at the point where it says that. It's already been accepted out of that ground of sovereign immunity. It's already been accepted out by the legislature. So when you say that there is no waiver of its sovereign immunity, if you just look at the plain words of the actual clause, there is no sovereign immunity. So when they say that there is no waiver of its sovereign immunity, it has to refer to some other part of sovereign immunity. At least that's certainly one contention. And of course, the other issue is this, is that if there's a fact issue with regard to the determination of what that clause actually means, then all of the evidence has to be considered most favorable to that of the non-movement. And so that when you look at the clause and you try to make a determination of exactly what it means, within this context of, obviously, the legislature being the body that has the authority to define the scope of what sovereign immunity is. And so these guys would have the court believe that somehow that a municipality, through Ryder Scott, who writes a contract and it contracts with ESCM, whether you want to call it a sophisticated party and engineering firm that understands the law or doesn't understand the law, I'm going to get to the point that the fact that the clause itself, you could never construct the clause to believe that somehow that they waive their right to a remedy to force the city to respect their obligation to them. And the other thing is this is a municipality. Now, it's a home rule city, I believe. It's not an independent sovereign. They're not a state actor. The mayor is not a state actor. The city attorney is not a state actor. They're not state officials. Sovereign immunity, in and of itself, is a statewide issue. And if they really want to be precise about what it means, then let's talk about the fact that it's actually governmental immunity. And governmental immunity is derived from sovereign immunity. But the fact of the matter is, if they say in there that somehow that they have reinstated sovereign immunity, when the legislature, which is the body, is the body of the people. So you've got the sovereign, which is the people. The people reflect their will through the Constitution and the statutes. Who's responsible for the statutes? The legislature. The legislature, therefore, has the authority to make a determination of exactly when it is that a city in this case has the authority, has consent to be sued. They make
it. Isn't the problem that the statute itself uses the phrase sovereign immunity in that section 271.152? Is that a mistake?
I think it could be. I certainly think, you know, the Houston case, there's a Houston, there's a good Supreme Court case that has the distinction between governmental immunity and sovereign immunity. And I think that in this case, by using the word sovereign immunity, that there is a little bit of an error by the legislature in the determination. But there is a distinction between the two. One is derived as a result of the other. So in order to buy the argument that somehow that a municipality, who they're not a state actor, it's just an agent of the state. So the legislature determines we've got a governmental function that needs to be done for the people in a specific area. They write a statute that says, okay, the city can do these particular governmental functions. They act as an agent of the state. So to affect somehow this idea, hey, I can only take sovereign immunity for what it is, which is sovereign immunity. And so when you write in there that somehow that you have now not waived sovereign immunity, it doesn't make any sense, let alone the fact that the authority, the lines of authority that are given to the municipality are specifically defined by statute. And so the discretion that's involved, the discretion that's allowed, is that which the legislature determines. So to have somebody who's sitting in a room writing up a contract and says, hey, I'm going to reinstate sovereign immunity. Are you kidding me? We're going to reinstate sovereign immunity? You don't even have the authority to do that. If you want to write into the contract, I'm sorry.
And doesn't it make a difference, though, because as to whether we're talking about a plea to the jurisdiction, which is a result of immunity from suit, as opposed to immunity from liability?
Yes. Yes, they're two separate issues, which I think kind of morphs us a little bit into the attorney fee issue, because it's a, you know, 153 and 152. 152 is obviously the the consent to suit and the sovereign immunity issue. 153 is if it's a limitation on the damages that are available, which is an immunity from liability question. And that was actually present in, I don't want to get too far skewed because I want to stay on sovereign immunity for one more second, but that was actually present in a case that was cited by the city. Now, it was a Houston case where in the dissent, they actually talked about it. They actually talked about the fact that this question about attorney fees is actually an immunity from liability issue as opposed to an immunity from suit. And because, and some of the, all the cases that have been cited so far with regard to, in the briefing, with regard to attorney fees, and this is the reason I think that it's not a justiciable point before the court. All of those particular cases regarding attorney fees, every one of those somehow misclassifies they call it a claim. They say this is a claim, and they put causes of action in with actually recovery of particular damages, which doesn't make any sense because they're causes of action. The cause of action is what brings an entity before court. It's not a claim. You don't have a claim for attorney fees or damages without the actual cause of action, which leads to the claim. And so I'm not sure, you know, the Houston appellate court that made that decision, I'm not sure they're correct. In fact, I venture to say that they're not. And I can say that in this court, hometown v. North Richland Hills, this court made a determination. I forget exactly who wrote that opinion. But this court made the determination that when there was an issue about the scope of damages, it said, hey, that's something that's going to better handled at the trial court level. The issue, that's not an immunity issue before us. Once the court decides that you are properly before the court, that is, it can litigate the cause of action, has the authority to litigate the cause of action, then the trial court will make a determination as to what the scope of those particular damages are. And so I don't think the attorney fee, look, our grounds, our legal grounds for the recovery of attorney fees. Let me make one other correction. There was no award of attorney fees in the pleaded jurisdiction. It was just simply a denial to the pleaded jurisdiction. So it was general. He could have denied it on any number of issues. And they had brought the quantum merit thing, which we just concede because quantum merit is a cause of action that there is no, there is immunity. The state or the city, the government entity is possessed of immunity with regard to quantum merit claims. The attorney fee issue, and so the court simply denied the plea to the jurisdiction without any specifics in that regard. So, but I don't think that we're on the firmest ground with regard to the recovery of attorney fees in light of the transition clause. I mean, I'll represent to the court in light of the transition clause on the statute. It's not codified, but there's a reference to it, obviously, because at the bottom of any codified law, you'll see a reference to the specific act. And in that act, there's a section that indicates that the recovery of attorney fees would be prospective. However, I'm not sure, given Tookie v. the City of Mejia, which is an interesting case, because in that case, the court almost, and I kind of, with regard to attorney fees, I kind of was moving it over to, I was trying to make an analogy. And so I referred to Tookie v. City of Mejia, which indicated, that court indicated, that the application of Local Government Code 271.152 was actually retroactive, and it examined the transition clause in the act, which is not actually codified as you read it in any code book. It's not codified, but they reflected it. But then the court said from this point forward, this is considered retroactive. And so then immediately, all the cases that were actually pending before particular courts were then, they had to relitigate, but they had to send it back down to the trial court in order to consider that particular issue. So I made an analogy that if you're gonna make it retroactive, and it seemed as if the Supreme Court did it on its authority as opposed to legislative dictate. And that's the reason I made the analogy that attorney fees would seem to me would make sense that to go back and to be retroactive, just like the application of 271.152 as of 2005 when that particular sovereign immunity issue was changed by the court. And the court, of course, did that in response to the fact that Tookie indicated that all of these particular charters and everything else where the language sue and be sued, that language was considered by the Supreme Court to be not specific enough. It was ambiguous. And so then the legislature then made a decision, well, son of a gun, I mean, if we've got entities out there, they've got to have a remedy. So then they went ahead and said, look, if you got a written contract, it's with the municipality, it's signed, and it's executed properly, and it's for the performance of goods and service, and the essential terms of the contract are there, then under those circumstances, there is no sovereign immunity. And so I have defined the scope of sovereign immunity, which is in the province of the legislature itself, period, nobody else. The judiciary makes a determination as to an application with regard to the statute, but the legislature makes a determination of exactly what sovereign immunity is. If you look at that clause, the parties agree that the city has not waived the sovereign immunity by entering into and executing this contract. Hey, the plain meaning of those words is simply, yeah, you're right, you haven't waived your sovereign immunity because the legislature already did it for you, number one. Number two, we've introduced evidence to the court through affidavit that our guy never understood in a million years that he couldn't, that there's no way that he could, that he wouldn't have a remedy under the contract. And furthermore, it's ambiguous with regard to the sovereign immunity and governmental immunity issue. Sovereign immunity, its sovereign immunity, could simply mean the sovereign immunity that it possesses. Because again, there is no authority by a city attorney or anybody else to act as a state actor and somehow change what the legislature's made a determination. Absolutely none as a municipality. Fairness dictates. And finally, the entire contract itself talks about litigation. It talks about venue. It talks about liability for funds that aren't budgeted past the current budget year. It talks about, there's a whole host, and I know that my time is up, but there's a whole host of things where the contract itself indicates that there's a contemplation of legislation. It's a binding agreement, et cetera, that you don't waive. There's a waiver provision that you don't waive a remedy at law based upon the fact that you may, that you're allowed to waive a particular provision that's agreed upon. I mean, there's a whole host of things in the contract, so you have to give meaning to all of the provisions of a contract in order to properly construe. And I appreciate your patience, and thank you very much, and have a good Thanksgiving.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Pratt, rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief. Please, the court. A few brief points on rebuttal. First, as to the immunity question, there were some questions over this governmental versus sovereign immunity issue. And admittedly, there is a difference if you read the cases and you look at everything that's out there in the realm of immunity authority. But the statute in this case says sovereign immunity. Regardless of whether that means to a governmental unit or the ultimate sovereign, it says sovereign immunity. And the contract tracks that language and itself says sovereign immunity. If the contract had said the city doesn't waive its governmental immunity, we'd have a whole other ambiguity question before this court. The contract matches the language of the statute, and by doing so, by reinstating sovereign immunity, the very language of the contract must be applied to hold that the city was not subject to the trial court's subject matter jurisdiction. Now, there was also a question or a statement that the city does not have the unilateral right to change its status. The city didn't do it on its own. The parties did. They entered into an agreement that had this provision in it. These are sophisticated parties. We're not dealing with the city and mom and pop. We're dealing with sophisticated parties who know how to negotiate a contract, who know how to read a contract, and know how to give effect to the terms of that contract. Giving an affidavit doesn't change what this contract says. What the contract says is what it says, and what it means is what it means.
And didn't you cite to several other examples where people can waive rights granted by statute? I mean, if I wanted to pursue a deceptive trade practice claim and waive my right to recover attorney fees, couldn't I do that?
Absolutely. I think you're looking at my notes, Judge, because my last point on this issue is, you know, the statement was made that we would never waive a remedy. Well, people do it all the time by contract, and that's exactly what happened here. So we're not jumping off a ledge to do something that's never been done before, and I'm not asking this court to do that. I'm asking this court to apply the contract as written.
Do you have a case where a provision like this has been enforced?
I do not, Judge. No, I don't.
So we are kind of jumping off the ledge.
Well, but a small edge. It's we're simply applying what's been done in the past with respect to waiver of rights or waiver of certain categories of claims and recovery, and we're applying it to this scenario.
But
and
you have to agree that sovereign immunity is kind of a unique, unique concept, because it is set by the legislature for policy reasons. It's not a cause of action like a DTPA claim or a, I mean, it's a policy decision by the legislature as to when there is going to be sovereign immunity and when there is not.
Agreed. And if we were asking the court to do the reverse, which is allow the city to waive something that the legislature hasn't, or to waive something that the legislature hasn't already waived, that would be different. That's what the cases that have dealt with this before have said. The city can't waive that which the legislature hasn't. But if the legislature is taking it away, why can't we put it back in by contract, especially when we have sophisticated parties agreeing to it? Now, real briefly on the attorney's fees question, we don't even get to the question under 153 without answering 152 first, because we can't give an award if the city's not allowed to be there. So it would make no sense not to address this through a plea to the jurisdiction if the questions under 152 were already raised. And finally, on the retroactivity question, the statute's clear. It says only after June 19th of 2009. The Supreme Court did not apply retroactively. That's the provision of the statute in the case that cited by the consultant. So there's no basis for doing so now.
Excuse me, I have a question. Do you have any?
No. You wish? Thank you.
I'm confused. When the legislature said there is no sovereign immunity under this limited circumstance, and the contract says we don't waive it by this contract, can the statement, for example, a statement that by agreeing to hear your oral argument, I do not waive my Finnish citizenship, does that confer Finnish citizenship on me?
No. Because there would be some level of bureaucratic steps that have to be taken. You have to fill your paperwork out and things of that nature.
And for immunity, when the legislature has specifically carved this out, does that then, by saying you don't waive something that you don't have, does that create the waiver? I mean, create the existence of immunity?
I believe it does, Your Honor. Yes, because we're not attempting to take something away that the legislature says we don't want to spend tax dollars on. We're putting something back as between two parties to a contract. So it's a limited waiver to begin with, and these parties simply agreed to put it back. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pratt, Mr. Smith, and Mr. DeVos. We appreciate you being here today. We also appreciate all your briefing in this matter. Your case is now submitted, and you all are excused. We will take a recess until 10:30 when we pick up our 10:30 case.